Hello and welcome to episode 2 of Everyone's an Expert. This week I speak to Scottish violinist Laura McMillan. We're friends and colleagues from our work with the Kaleidoscope Orchestra, and we have a great chat where Laura speaks insightfully and passionately about the role of music education. We talk a little bit about getting back to performing post-pandemic, and then slightly unexpectedly, we go pretty deep on the role of music in certain kids' TV shows that are close to our hearts. Hope you enjoy our chat. I'll speak to you a little more at the end. Enjoy! Laura, welcome to Everyone's an Expert. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me. It's really nice to be here.
This is a nice thing to do. I should tell listeners that we are engaged in some stealth podding between baby naps.
Yeah, I'm actually just going to turn off the white noise that's coming through my phone, or we're going to have like ocean sounds coming through the entire podcast.
That's okay. I find that I actually quite like the white noise from ours. I've gotten into it on a personal level now.
Yeah, no, I'm the same. I actually can't fall asleep without it now. I've got so used to hearing it over the last 7 months that now that she's through in her own room, I'm lying there at night like, so quiet.
Yeah. So I was trying to remember when it would have been the first time that we worked together. I think I've got an idea of it, but...
Goodness. I reckon it was maybe 2016, 2017 with Kaleidoscope.
I think so too. Yeah.
Around about then.
Have you done the Kaleidoscope thing right from the start, or?
So I wasn't in it originally from the very beginning, no. In my previous job, I wasn't allowed to take any time off during term time.
Right, okay.
So there was lots of things that Rhiannon had asked me to do that I'd have to say, I'm really sorry, I'm not allowed.
So you were at college with those guys, right?
No. I went to the, it's now the Royal Conservatoire of Scotland, but it was the RSAMD when I was there.
Oh, awesome. Right.
And I think I got to know people through various different strands when I moved down to Liverpool.
I kind of made that stupid assumption of the, just the RNCM blob.
The bubble.
Apologies for that. So yeah, what took you down to Liverpool then? That was a super interesting job, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I finished my degree and did a year of freelancing in Scotland and didn't really enjoy it, if I'm being totally honest, which I know is a very taboo thing to say, but there were various reasons where I thought, you know, I'm not enjoying playing on this orchestral scene. I was very young, I was only 21 at the time, and I had real imposter syndrome the fact that I was playing with the orchestras that I'd grown up with. So I thought, no. And then I watched a documentary about children in West Everton going to play at Goodison Park. I remember thinking, wow, this is really cool. Like this method of teaching where music is immersed in a primary school. And then a maternity cover came up for it. So I thought, right, I'm going to go for that. And I got the job, and it was meant to only be for 6 months. So for the 6 months, I actually still lived in Scotland, but traveled to Liverpool and back twice a week for a year in the end, because the contract got extended and yeah. I didn't want to commit to moving down. And the whole job was about using music as a social transformation tool. So all of the kind of principles that you would have in the orchestra applying to things like, sorry, that's my front door. I'll turn that off. It was a nice magical sound as we were talking about stuff there. Brilliant. So using all the kind of disciplines and principles in the orchestra to give children a sense of self-confidence, grit, resilience, all these things that, as you know yourself, learning an instrument, it's not an instantly gratifying thing. It takes time, it takes work, it takes commitment. And that was something that we were trying to give to this whole school. You know, the teachers learned, the dinner ladies learned. The head teacher played the double bass, which was really cool. Sister Moira, if she ever listens to this. I always thought it was brilliant that she was really into the double bass. So yeah, that was what brought me down to Liverpool in the end.
Oh, wow. And how long were you in Liverpool for?
So I lived in Liverpool for 7 years. My mum's family were originally from St. Helens, so I already had quite a tie to the area. And yeah, my job at the Liverpool Phil kind of expanded a bit. So I worked for Enharmony, but I also did stuff for the youth choirs and the youth orchestra and other kind of smaller outreach projects that the Phil's education department were involved in. And then I got involved with bands and quartets and all the stuff that comes with being a freelance musician, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm super biased because it's kind of the place in the world I'm roughly from, but I think Liverpool's a really special city for music.
I couldn't agree more. It's really interesting. One of the songs that my band covers at the end of one of our bigger gigs in Liverpool is "The Leaving of Liverpool," and I don't think there's ever been, I don't think there's ever been a year where I haven't actually just started to well up on stage, because now that I don't live there anymore, I'm like, oh, I could be singing this myself.
Oh yeah, because I mean I know everybody's always like, oh yeah, the beat, you know, every kind of rock and roll documentary that's about the Beatles, and you know, oh, it makes out that Liverpool was the only place you could get rock and roll records and all this kind of nonsense. But in terms of the time that, you know, the times we live in, I still think there's a real proud indigenous culture around Liverpool and Merseyside that I
Absolutely.
don't think is necessarily the same in other cities. I recognize my bias, but I don't know. I think there's a combination of people like yourself that come into Liverpool and become kind of honorary Scousers. But there's an awful lot of
Absolutely.
creative people that don't, are like, why would I ever want to live anywhere else? And are really proud of that heritage.
Sorry, I'm just looking and I can see the baby's waking up. You're gonna have to give me 2 seconds.
That's
I'll
all
be right
right.
back.
You do your thing.
Liverpool, yes. So
Yeah.
the whole culture in Liverpool, do you know, it's really interesting. I've always been like a massive Oasis fan, and I'm also a huge Charlatans fan. So there's that kind of real breadth of the Northwest worth of music that's influenced me. But the thing that I find the most special about Liverpool is the real kind of depth of cultural identity that's there. So there's a huge traditional music community that you perhaps don't get kind of further into the Northwest because of the links with Ireland. And then also there's so many different ethnic minorities that live within Liverpool. So you've got the Africa Oyè Festival, for example, which is just this incredible celebration of music. And like you say, yes, there's the Beatles. Of course there's the Beatles. But if you're actually in the Museum of Liverpool, the number of musicians that have had an impact on the city, with the likes of John Power with Cast, or the Lads, or the Coral, which obviously they're not directly from Liverpool, but I mean they're only over the water, as they say, you
Yeah,
know.
I mean, because I am of that persuasion, I'll kind of always include the Wirral in the broader area.
Absolutely.
Again, I'm
Absolutely.
just imparting my own bias on that, but I guess that's true with one of the acts that you collaborate with, play with.
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, the Wirral I would always include as a Merseyside music base. And I know it's classed as Cheshire. I used to live in Hoylake for a while, but I met so many musicians who were, you know, I'm going to say something very taboo here. A Scouse is a Scouser. I know there's an awful
Yeah,
lot
I
of
know what you mean, yeah.
there's a lot of kind of, oh well, there, you know, they're from the Wirral, but not at all. And the amount of influence that those musicians from the Wirral have had on Scouse music, it would be unfair to class them as not having an impact on the music scene in Liverpool. But my main band is with Ian Prowse, and he's from Ellesmere Port, which, you know, is about as far south on the Wirral into Cheshire as you're going to get. So
Yeah. Oh,
yeah.
I didn't realize that, because I know he's a Tranmere fan. I've associated him with Birkenhead.
So
But
no,
yeah,
he's
I'm
not.
from Neston, which is the town next to Ellesmere Port. That's like the
Yeah, I know
same port, yeah.
Neston. I know Neston. No, Ian's from the port, as he says quite regularly. But I mean, he's lived in Liverpool for years now, and his daughter's Scouse, so he's as Scouse as you're gonna get.
There you go.
So yeah.
So you guys have got exciting things on the horizon, right?
Yeah, it's been quite phenomenal, really. So Ian's career spans 30 years now, and he's re-released a lot of his earlier albums from his first band, Pelly, and we've done kind of UK tours of the Fireworks album, the Sport of Kings album, and then there's been a couple of other new albums that have come out along that time, and then we were really honoured to be invited to be special guests of Elvis Costello, because Ian and Elvis have a long-standing relationship there, and he invited us to go on tour just before the pandemic. And unfortunately, just after the London Hammersmith gig, we were told to go home, take our instruments and go home. And within 5 days, the country went into the first lockdown. So over that time, Ian was doing a weekly live performance on Facebook, and he's created this huge community of Prowsey shipmates. They all refer to it as the good ship Prowsey. And as a result of various different things, we were able to record an album whilst in our respective homes. So we've just had a new album coming out, so we've got an album launch tour around the UK that starts in 4 weeks. I want to say it's the 26th of March, and we start in Nottingham. And then, just so unbelievably, we've been invited back to do a second guest slot with Elvis around the UK in June. So we're away for a whole 3 weeks in June, which is just, I'm buzzing. I can't wait.
That's going to go off as well, because that's supporting his new album, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we've got.
Have you listened to it?
I've listened to a couple of tracks on it. I'll be totally honest, actually getting to sit and listen to music at the moment.
Right, yeah, okay, sure.
But the babies around is just...
I had a long drive. I checked it out. It's just great.
Oh, I mean, it's one of these... Elvis is one of these musicians who, again, has had such a prolific effect on Merseybeat music. I do need to actually just give myself the time to sit down and listen to it.
It's a treat, because to me, I don't know, it harks back to a lot of the old Attraction stuff.
Right.
His voice sounds amazing. Sounds really agile.
There's no other voice like it. That's the bit that I always find really fascinating. You know, you get so many kind of Merseybeat voices, you could kind of say, oh well, that's come from there and that's come from there. There hasn't been another voice like Costello's. He is his own genre in a way.
Yeah, because I mean, it's kind of it's aged beautifully, but mm-hmm. even when you go back to the first stuff from the late 70s, there's kind of a character, a persona that's already pretty fully formed there.
Absolutely.
With all the little affectations and stuff, it's so cool.
Well, to have seen him on stage live when we did the first tour was just phenomenal, and all of his band as well, and how they all kind of marry together. It's just, yeah, it's phenomenal having a career that has spanned that length of time, diversified, but also kept its own identity. I think any musician who's capable of that is really special.
Yeah, that's the gold dust, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So that's going to be a really interesting couple of tours, because you play some really cool kind of esoteric venues with Ian Prowse, don't you?
Yeah, we certainly do.
Are you doing that place, the Crook Barn in Appletreewick?
So
I've noticed that on I've noticed that on previous itineraries, because I've played weddings there. but that's such a random venue.
It's brilliant. You know, I'm not doing that one. This is one of these things where being Scottish, you look at the pronunciation of a place name and you think, can't be that, and actually it is. So Appletreewick is actually pronounced Attrick.
Amazing. I've been like four times. I've deliberately gone there and camped there, because I did a gig there and I was like, I've got to go back there, and I've been calling it the wrong thing. Although you'd never find it
well
on a map if you didn't call it that.
So
Attrick.
Attrick, yeah. And the Crook Barn, those gigs are, I think they are organised by mutual musician friends Nick Hall and Michelle Plum.
Right, okay.
And think they kind of organize and coordinate a lot of the gigs there, and it's just the most beautiful venue because you know yourself, it's really intimate, but it's just such a special evening when you're there. So we're not doing that one, but we do have some pretty cool venues coming up. I'm actually just going to get the list out because I can never remember what half of them are when I'm looking at them. Bear with me, just dig it out. I had there they are. So we've got the Leeds Brudenell. Now that's my absolute favorite place to go.
Yeah.
It's so quirky for a social club as well. It's just really, really cool. I love it there. And then we're doing a gig in Edinburgh, which we haven't done in the 10 years that I've been in the band, and that's at the Voodoo Rooms. So that's going to be good fun. And the other one that I really enjoy playing at is the Cluny in Newcastle.
Right, okay. Yeah, that's a
That's
great
quite a
venue.
funky venue.
Yeah.
So yeah, lots of exciting places to go. And then on the opposite end of the spectrum, when we do the Elvis tour, it's insane venues like Birmingham Symphony Hall or back to the Hammersmith Apollo. And normally the band goes out as a six piece. But we're just going acoustically, so there could be as little as three of us on stage. So you're kind of aware of this huge expanse of space, which for those venues, I'm used to playing with an orchestra.
Yeah.
So it feels very exposed, but also really cool that it's just your violin that's filling that entire room, as opposed to kind of 40 others.
Yeah. Oh, that's going to be wild. That's great. Well, I'm extremely excited for you.
Thank you.
That's going to be quite a gear shift, given the fact that we've all spent quite a lot of time not touring.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how have you found it kind of being back on the road with stuff. I'd be interested to get your perspective on that.
Well, I'm not sure. I haven't really toured. I've been back out playing an awful lot, but kind of in regular venues, a lot in city centres.
But
So
even
I've kind of
then,
mainly
I've
been in Manchester. The first few weeks that I did it, I did a handful of gigs when restrictions were kind of lifted a little bit in the summer in 2020, which was kind of deeply weird and felt like it wasn't real. But then when things, the end of 2021 started to come back round again. October was super busy. It was like a kind of explosion of that sort of thing. And to
It's
begin with,
really
it was
interesting.
little bit odd.
Yeah.
And around Christmas, I was doing a lot of work, but just felt like I was the specter of COVID was still looming large. But I think that, I don't know, I think there's been a change since Christmas because there wasn't actually a lockdown and we seem to be coming out the other side of it.
Yeah, I mean, certainly you're not the first person to say that, which is why I asked. So for me, going back to touring, I think I'll slot into place with. But going back to gigging after COVID was the most surreal experience. And I say after COVID, which after COVID, which lockdown do we talk about there, right? So the first kind of bigger gig that I had was 9 months. I'd done nothing for 9 months, which I worked out was the longest I'd gone without performing since before I started the violin. I think I'd probably done more performances as a child at school than I had in that year, which blew my mind. But that was at the Liverpool Phil because that was the only venue that could house the band at Christmas where we could be far enough apart on stage.
That's
So
right. So was that was Christmas 2020.
2020,
So
yeah.
yeah, I did a really probably one of the only things that happened. I did something at the arena in Liverpool with the Classic Rock Show.
Wow.
They've got a couple of I've historically been a part of that, but some of the American band members couldn't come over, so I came back to do a one-off similar sort of thing.
Sure.
It was in the arena, but it wasn't really an arena gig. It so that
Yeah.
audience could be spaced and that kind of thing, but
Just
that
bizarre.
felt really surreal to be going into, to be coming out of months of not really doing very much,
Or
to sort of,
seeing anyone in person.
to sort of full production, and this little taste of, not exactly normality, like a Zatz normality.
Well, we're quite a close band as well. Like we're quite a huggy kind of band, and we live all over the UK. You know, we're as far flung as me in Scotland, right the way down to Bournemouth. So, you know, there's quite a geographical spread. And when we all came together, it was kind of like, all right, how you doing? You didn't want to kind of hug each other or whatever, but it just felt very alien. And then for me as well, I was in the very early stages of pregnancy at that point, which the band all knew because I was being so sick. I had hyperemesis,
Oh,
so
bless you.
it was impossible to hide that. But again, I was kind of there going, should I be doing this gig? I mean, am I in danger? I don't know. You know, does it affect pregnancy? Does it not? And then, you know, as the pregnancy progressed, more information came out about all of that. But yeah, it was just bizarre. And then I didn't actually gig again until June 2021. So that was March 2020 into December 2020 into June 2021. And I kind of, it's amazing how you slot back into that situation, but also how alien it felt to be with other people and how emotional it felt to be sitting with other people making music in person. You know, the kind of things that I would normally play at a wedding where I'd be going, okay, play this for the 100th time. I was getting quite emotional about, you know, take that's greatest day.
I found exactly the same thing. It's just sort of realizing that it is a pretty great thing to do. It's kind of a useful, aside from all of the obvious negative things about it, I found it a really good reset for my state of mind about doing any kind of gig. Because I guess
Absolutely.
you must be the same as me, and you don't. I mean, I'm pretty good because I generally enjoy what I'm playing because my tastes are pretty broad, but I'm just lucky in that respect. But there are some things that are more workaday than others, right? Whereas I've found it hasn't quite worn off yet. I'm still really pretty happy to be going out to work and playing
Absolutely.
whatever
I
the gig
couldn't.
is. And I don't know that I was necessarily too cynical previously, but it certainly has helped to reset that.
Do you know, I couldn't agree more. I've got quite an eclectic music taste. You know, I've got the things that I enjoy more, but I'll listen to pretty much anything. I mean, that was certainly something that I got taken the mick out of me when I was at music college back in the day because I love dance music. I've always loved dance music. So it was Laura the Ned, or the Chav as it is in England, or the Scal or whatever. But then I would also listen to kind of much heavier rock music, and then Mahler symphonies or Stravinsky or Shostakovich string quartets. And then equally as much, I love traditional music. And I think that was actually what introduced me to my husband, because I needed some help with learning how to play trad stuff more authentically. Like I could always busk a bit, but I always felt like a bit of a fraud.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, I hadn't done any kind of trad stuff since I was a child. That was all I did as a child was trad stuff, and then moved on to classical. So yeah, it's something that when I'm out and about, I just really appreciate the fact that I actually play the violin for a living. It was something that I had teachers at school that would say I'd never make a living out of that. And every day that I actually get to make a living out of it, I think, haha, I showed you.
Yeah, for me,
it's.
it's like I just keep getting to different birthdays and going, oh, I'm still getting away with this. This is good. And you have kids and you go, hang on, I'm still doing it. This is good.
Absolutely. Do you get asked the question, or when are you putting your kids to the piano? Do you ever
Oh,
get that?
yeah. I mean, I guess, yeah, because I don't know about you. Both my siblings work in I. kind of mu my brother's a musician and my sister works in musical theatre, so I think
Wow.
it kind of means that because we're all kind of professional performers, it's like, oh well, there's some sort of assumption. Kind of nervous about it. I've got a few friends that are a bit older and their kids are coming to music. I think they've dealt with it really well, that they've just kind of left all of the gear lying around but haven't forced it on them. And
Absolutely.
I think at the moment that's what I'd like to try and do, is just kind of make sure that they see me doing it, but that it's not too forced on them.
Absolutely. We're both violinists. So I mean, I think Saoirse was a matter of weeks old, and it was, oh, when are you be putting her to the fiddle? And I was like, if she asks me, I don't ever want her to feel like she has to follow in mummy and daddy's footsteps. And she can do it if she wants to. And if she decides that she doesn't like the violin and she would rather play a different instrument, that's fine. If she decides that she doesn't want to play any instrument and she would like to go into professional basketball or, just do anything for a hobby, that's fine.
Yeah,
It's
I
totally
think the
fine.
thing for me when I think about growing up, the thing that was so great about growing up playing music was that I always had something to do that I was really into. So to me, it happens to be about music. But like you say, if that was about sport or if that was about some other kind of hobby, then I think it's just that thing of every day feeling excited about something and feeling
Part of something.
enthused and part of something. All those relationships that you have through that.
That's what I love so much about working for a Sistema organisation. So I now work for Sistema Scotland rather than Sistema England. That was why I moved back to Scotland. I had ended up with a job at Big Noise Raploch, and it's exactly the same as Enharmony was and still is. It's all about the belonging to something, and music is the tool. And yes, you have high expectations when you're in the classes with the young people, but it's so that they have high expectations of themselves and they realize that, this is something that's for the long haul. But there's all those kind of softer targets, if you wanted to call them. You're not just ticking boxes, or they can hold their bow, they can play this piece, they can do that, but it's the have they turned up to the rehearsal every day this week? Have
Sure,
they
yeah.
stayed in their chair for any length of time? Have they learned to read one new note on the stave? All these things that actually give them that feeling of, oh, I can actually do this, I've learned something new. And that's the thing I loved as a child, because the town that I grew up in is the town that I now live back in Denny, and there weren't many people that played classical violin. I was very much the outsider with that at school, and I used to go and hide in the music department. And then when I started going to youth orchestra courses, or just even the community youth orchestra in Falkirk, it was just something nice to look forward to, because you were with like-minded people that wanted to do the same thing as you. And
Yeah,
that was
yeah.
just, that was the bit that gave me such a buzz, not just the amazing music, but actually the belonging.
Yeah. I think there's probably similar stories for a lot of people that then end up pursuing it professionally. I was really fortunate that we had a quite active school band. It was just a regular school. Just happened to have a school band that would play gigs, kind of played pop music. It's kind of like an augmented big band. And it's
That's
produced
cool.
quite a few professional musicians, but I've ended up living back in the city that I grew up in as well. And I quite often bump into people that were in that band who don't do that anymore, but it's still a big part of their kind of background and what we have in common. And they've got great memories of doing that at school. That kind of self-esteem thing that builds into people is really important,
Yeah.
isn't it? And I think actually that's more important than producing professional musicians. In a lot of cases, people will probably, if
Absolutely.
they've got that burning desire to do that, they'll probably find a way to do that. But
Oh,
creating,
this is something, a running tangent I could go on about
yeah,
that. I completely agree.
but creating scenarios where students just in that moment have something to do together and, like you say, generate self-esteem. I think it's pretty remarkable to have organizations that are able to do that at the level that you are, especially given, I mean, not to get too outwardly political, but especially given the fact that that's kind of opposite to the direction of travel of most British educational policy in the last 10 years.
I mean, I don't think it's been without its battles. Certainly, when I worked in England, looking at the way funding was going for any kind of community music, it was being tightened and tightened and
Yeah,
tightened.
yeah.
And in Scotland, I think, with the devolution of government, there is more choice up here. But I mean, as the cost of living rises and all these other things, it's still baffles me that music is seen as a luxury subject when actually, when you think about what music impacts on, like the first thing my daughter heard as she was born into the world was Ian singing, because when I was going into theatre for my C-section, they said, you could have some music on in the background, you can make a playlist. And the only thing I could think of to have on was Ian's stuff, because it would help me focus on the fact that, you know, I knew those songs really well, and not thinking about what was happening right. Otherwise. So there was that. And then you think about children's toys. They push a button, music comes out. You put the TV on, every single child's television programme has a theme tune. And then if you really look deeply into it, I've been watching a lot of In the Night Garden.
Yeah, talk to me. Talk to me about In the Night Garden.
In the Night Garden. So, first of all, I don't know whether Lewis Carroll came back from the dead and decided he was going to do a sequel to Alice in Wonderland with that, but it is trippy.
It's some creepy shit, but it works, doesn't it? Oh, my God.
Like, the bit that gets me, so... I could talk about this all day. This is a whole other episode of podcast. But
no, this is good. Go in on it. This is okay, it's not. I don't think it's as niche as we think it is. So
okay, this is my evaluation and assessment of In the Night Garden. Okay, so I love that every single character has their own musical theme. On top of that, I love that there's phonetic exploration with each of the rhymes that they do, because you listen to it the first time and you're thinking, what are they on about? But actually it's about getting them to explore their mouth and make sounds that they perhaps wouldn't do otherwise, and it's the repetition of that. Then I don't quite understand why they can't call the birds something like birds, and instead they're called titifers. I don't know what that's all about. And also, why is it so discordant?
I kind of love it.
I do now. I didn't at the beginning. I right, was like, yeah. What are you trying to do to me?
It's because there's moments where it's like deliberately discordant, isn't it?
Yeah, and
especially with those
me.
With those titifers, yeah.
Well, I walk around the house singing their little tune when it comes on. I'm going, what like this. I come away going, Laura, come on now.
So tell me, have you discovered Moon and Me?
Yes, my husband came across that. I don't know what it is about kids TV. I've been too stuck in my ways. So she watches a lot of Teletubbies just because it makes her laugh.
Yeah.
What's really interesting about that is that it's the tuba that makes her laugh. Tinky Winky is represented by a tuba.
Wow. You see, I haven't gone back to Teletubbies. My understanding is, though, the Teletubbies in the Night Garden and Moon and Me are the brainchild of all of the same person.
Well, I can see that now. What I find really interesting is that, again, each of the characters are represented by a different instrument. And when Tinky Winky comes out and goes, bah, 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 she thinks it's hysterical. And I thought it was just a one-off. So I kept putting the episodes on to see how she would react. And when the baby's in the sun, she's there, she's smiling. She smiles back and laughs back. And then, like I say, Tinky Winky comes out and she just bursts out laughing. So I have come across Moon and Me, but it was my husband that discovered it. And wow, I mean, the moon baby needs help.
Yeah, well, I mean, we talk about the assessment there. And my assessment of that is that, I mean, it's got the same kind of musical thing with the use of leitmotif and that, you know, that thing of them all having their own themes. There's also some cool things when they actually play music together, because of the weird animation, they hit the drums out of time, but they'll make sure that someone is actually hitting a drum out of time in the track, which is a lovely point of detail. But yeah,
well,
my...
It's the same in the Night Garden. So anytime you watch In the Night Garden, it's Derek Jacobi.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, renowned Shakespearean actor, who's doing all of the narration. And when he's doing the, yes, my name is Eagle Pig, it's always just slightly out of time. And it drives me and my husband absolutely demented. We don't understand why.
Well, and every episode is a reread. Uh-huh. They don't reuse any of that. It's kind of amazing. So it's like he's going, yeah. Right, how can I vary that slightly?
He swings it sometimes. Have you noticed that?
Yeah. Yeah, so the whole thing's utterly bizarre. And I mean, this probably is more niche, but my assessment of Moon and Me is that, but and I think we watched this a lot during the deep dark lockdown of early 21. So this is probably more of a reflection of my state of mind. But I think Peppy Nana is basically it's a house full of vulnerable adults that she kind of rules over in a kind of psycho bully kind of way.
Right.
And Moon Baby is the drug dealer that comes to the house every night. Because he very much has a kind of train spotter kind of vibe, doesn't he?
Absolutely. I mean,
and it's definitely really Mank.
Oh, without a doubt. It was
Moon
just Bez,
Baby.
Baby. No, going back to In the Night Garden, it's really interesting how my husband characterizes each of them. He calls Iggle Piggle Corpse Man. Why is Corpse Man being sent on a Viking longboat to die at the end of each episode? Because he's there lying down, he's got his thing over him, and it's just this thing sailing away. And then Upsy Daisy, I love Upsy Daisy. I love the kind of slightly ditzy attitude that she has. It's brilliant. I do also love the Tombly Boos, and I think it's ingenious that they're called Tombly Boo, Un, Oo, and E, instead of 1, 2, and 3, and I just think that's clever.
The whole thing is just really deeply, deeply clever, and music is sort of woven into how that, music in the sense of song, and in the sense of sort of orchestration.
Absolutely, and repetition and sounds as well, you know, like the Pinky Ponk. The sounds that come out of that. There was one day, my daughter must have only been about 4.5 months old, and she was, we normally finish the day with a bit of In the Night Garden, not for me, but because she actually really likes it. It chills her out before bed. And the Pinky Ponk came on and it was doing its usual brap stuff. And then she started doing it back and I was like, hang on a minute. And then the Tombly Boos came on doing their little high-pitched squeaking, and then she started doing it back, and I thought, this is incredible. Okay, I'm on board. I'm on the train. I'm still going. I'm going to keep up with this. But it's just, yeah, ingenious. And that's how I just find, how can music be seen as a luxury when even on that kind of deep-rooted level, it's present in everything? Oh, but that's something for, you know, well-off children to do, or that's something, you know, contrary to that now because of the Sistema projects that have opened up, that's something that the poor kids get to do, which is just the most horrible label anyway. It's something that everyone gets to do, no matter their gender, race, the bank balance, any of these things. Yeah. It's just openly accessible.
So there you go. Many thanks to Laura for giving up her time. Next week, my guest is journalist and broadcaster Sam Delaney. We chat about the power of music for triggering nostalgia, and we also talk about music's fundamental role in shaping popular culture, amongst other things. So check that out. See you soon. Thanks a lot. Bye.